the oldest white laxes in clover. They smiled and chit-chatted as they led me from their front door into a living room filled with pastel-blue overstuffed chairs and Confederate flags, one in each ashtray, several on the coffee table, and a full-sized one on a stand in the corner. Like Henrietta and Day, Carlton and Ruby were first cousins before they became husband and wife. They were both related to Robin Lax, the father of Albert, Ben, and Winston Lax, which made them Henrietta and Day's distant cousins. Carlton and Ruby had been married for decades and had more children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren than they could count. All they knew for sure was that there were more than 100 of them. Carlton was a frail man in his late 80s, with skin so pale it looked almost translucent. Tufts of hair like overgrown cotton sprouted from his head, brow, ears, and nostrils as he sat in his easy chair, mumbling about his years working the bank at a tobacco warehouse.
"I wrote out the checks," he said, mostly to himself. "I was the tobacco king."
Ruby was in her late 80s, too, with a sharp mind that seemed decades younger than her frail body. She talked right over Carlton, telling me about their grandfather who'd farmed the Lax plantation and their relation to Ben and Albert Lax. When I mentioned that Henrietta came from Laxtown, Ruby straightened in her chair.
"Well, that was colored," she snapped. "I don't know what you're talking about. You're not talking about coloreds, are you?"
I told her I wanted to learn about both the white and black Laxes.
"Well, we never did know each other," she said. "The white and the black didn't mix then. Not like they do now, which I can't say I like because I don't think it's for the best."
She paused and shook her head.
"Mixing them like that, during school and church and everything. They end up white and black, get together and marry and all. I just can't see the sense in it."
When I asked how she and Carlton were related to the black Laxes, they looked at each other from across the coffee table like I'd asked if they were born on Mars.
"My daddy's uncle kept a lot of the colored Laxes as slaves," Ruby said. "That must be where they got their name. Evidently, they took it when they left the plantation. That's the only thing I can figure."
Later, I asked Henrietta's sister Gladys what she thought of their theory. Though she'd lived about a mile from Carlton and Ruby Lax most of her 90 years, Gladys said she'd never heard of them.
"Black and white Lax is kin," Gladys said, "but we don't mix."
She pointed under the couch where I was sitting.
"Get Lillian's letter,"
she said to her son, Gary. As far as Gladys knew, all of Henrietta's other siblings were dead, except maybe Lillian, the youngest. The last anyone had heard from Lillian was a letter she'd sent sometime in the 80s, which Gladys kept in a shoebox under the couch. In it, Lillian wrote,
"I heard Daddy died in a fire,"
and she asked if it was true. It was. He died in 1969, 2 decades before she sent that letter. But what Lillian really wanted to know was who'd been talking to people about her life. She'd won the lottery, she said, and she believed someone was trying to kill her because white folks had been coming around asking questions about her life in Clover and her family, especially Henrietta.
"They knew things I didn't even know," she wrote. "I don't think anybody should talk about other people."
No one in the family had heard from her since.
"Lillian converted to Puerto Rican,"
Gladys said, holding the letter to her chest. I looked at Gary, who sat beside her.
"Lillian's skin was real light, even lighter than Mom's," Gary explained. "She married a Puerto Rican somewhere in New York. Since she could pass, she disowned her blackness, converted to Puerto Rican, because she didn't want to be black no more."
Chapter 17. Illegal, Immoral, and Deplorable. 1954 to 1966. As Gila grew like crabgrass in laboratories around the world, a virologist named Chester Southam had a frightening thought. What if Henrietta's cancer cells could infect the scientists working on them? Guy and several others had already shown that some rats grew tumors when injected with live Gila. Why not humans? Researchers were breathing in the air around Gila cells, touching them and transferring them from vial to vial, even eating lunch at lab tables beside them. One had used them to grow a vaccine for a common cold-like virus, which he'd injected, along with bits of Gila, into more than 400 people. Yet no one knew whether a person could actually catch cancer from Gila or other cancer cells.
"There is the possible danger," Southam wrote, "of initiating neoplastic disease by accidental inoculation during laboratory investigation, or by injection with such cells or cell products if they should be used for production of virus vaccine."
Southam was a well-respected cancer researcher and chief of virology at Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research. He and many other scientists believed that cancer was caused by either a virus or an immune system deficiency. So Southam decided to use Gila to test those theories. In February 1954, Southam loaded a syringe with saline solution mixed with Gila. He slid the needle into the forearm of a woman who'd recently been hospitalized for leukemia, then pushed the plunger, injecting about 5 million of Henrietta's cells into her arm. Using a second needle, Southam tattooed a tiny speck of India ink next to the small bump that formed at the Gila injection site. That way, he'd know where to look when he re-examined the woman days, weeks, and months later to see if Henrietta's cancer was growing on her arm. He repeated this process with about a dozen other cancer patients. He told them he was testing their immune systems. He said nothing about injecting them with someone else's malignant cells. Within hours, the patient's forearms grew red and swollen. 5 to 10 days later, hard nodules began growing at the injection sites. Southam removed some of the nodules to verify that they were cancerous, but he left several to see if the patient's immune systems would reject them or the cancer would spread. Within 2 weeks, some of the nodules had grown to 2 centimeters, about the size of Henrietta's tumor when she went in for her radium treatments. Southam eventually removed most of the Gila tumors, and those he didn't remove vanished on their own in a few months. But in 4 patients, the nodules grew back. He removed them, but they returned again and again. In 1 patient, Henrietta's cancer cells metastasized to her lymph nodes. Since those patients all had cancer to begin with, Southam wanted to see how healthy people reacted to the injections, for comparison's sake. So in May 1956, he placed an ad in the Ohio State Penitentiary newsletter. "Physician seeks 25 volunteers for cancer research." A few days later, he had 96 volunteers, which quickly increased to 150. He chose the Ohio prison because its inmates had cooperated in several other studies without resistance, including one in which they'd been infected with a potentially deadly disease called tularemia. Research on inmates would come under scrutiny and start being heavily regulated about 15 years later, because they'd be considered a vulnerable population unable to give informed consent. But at the time, prisoners nationwide were being used for research of all kinds, from testing chemical warfare agents to determining how X-raying testicles affected sperm count. Southam began injecting prisoners in June 1956 using Gila cells that his colleague, Alice Moore, carried from New York to Ohio in a handbag. 65 prisoners, murderers, embezzlers, robbers, and forgers, lined up on wooden benches for their injections. Some wore white hospital garb. Others came off work gangs wearing blue dungarees. Soon, tumors grew on the prisoners' arms just as they'd grown in the cancer patients. The press ran story after story about the brave men at the Ohio Penitentiary, praising them as the first healthy human beings ever to agree to such rigorous cancer experiments. They quoted one man saying,
"I'd be lying if I said I wasn't worried. You lie there on your bunk, knowing you've got cancer in your arm? Boy, what you think about."
Again and again, reporters asked, "Why did you volunteer for this test?" The prisoners' replies were like a refrain.
"I done a girl a great injustice, and I think it'll pay back a little bit what I did to her. I believe the wrong that I have done in the eyes of society, this might make a right on it."
Southam gave multiple cancer cell injections to each prisoner, and unlike the terminally ill patients, those men fought off the cancer completely. And with each new injection, their bodies responded faster, which seemed to indicate that the cells were increasing the inmates' immunity to cancer. When Southam reported his results, the press hailed them as a tremendous breakthrough that could someday lead to a cancer vaccine. In the coming years, Southam injected HeLa and other living cancer cells into more than 600 people for his research, about half of them cancer patients. He also began injecting them into every gynecologic surgery patient who came to Sloan Kettering's Memorial Hospital or its James Ewing Hospital. If he explained anything, he simply said he was testing them for cancer. And he believed he was. Since people with cancer seemed to reject the cells more slowly than healthy people did, Southam thought that by timing the rejection rate, he might be able to find undiagnosed cases of cancer. In a statement he'd later repeat again and again during hearings about his research, Southam wrote, "It is, of course, inconsequential whether these are cancer cells or not, since they are foreign to the recipient and hence are rejected. The only drawback to the use of cancer cells is the phobia and ignorance that surrounds the word cancer." Because of that phobia and ignorance, Southam wrote, he didn't tell patients the cells were cancerous because he didn't want to cause any unnecessary fear. As he would say, "To use the dreaded word cancer in connection with any clinical procedure on an ill person is potentially deleterious to that patient's well-being, because it may suggest to him, rightly or wrongly, that his diagnosis is cancer or that his prognosis is poor. To withhold such emotionally disturbing but medically non-pertinent details is in the best tradition of responsible clinical practice." But Southam wasn't their doctor, and he wasn't withholding upsetting health information. The deception was for his benefit. He was withholding information because patients might have refused to participate in his study if they'd known what he was injecting. And Southam probably would have continued doing this for years had he not made an arrangement on July 5, 1963, with Emanuel Mandel, director of medicine at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn, to use the hospital's patients for his research. The plan was that Mandel would have doctors on his staff inject 22 JCDH patients with cancer cells for Southam. But when he instructed his staff to give the injections without telling patients they contained cancer cells, three young Jewish doctors refused, saying they wouldn't conduct research on patients without their consent. All three knew about the research Nazis had done on Jewish prisoners. They also knew about the famous Nuremberg trials. 16 years earlier, on August 20, 1947, a U.S.-led international war tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany, had sentenced seven Nazi doctors to death by hanging. Their crime was conducting unthinkable research on Jews without consent, sewing siblings together to create Siamese twins, dissecting people alive to study organ function. The tribunal set forth a 10-point code of ethics, now known as the Nuremberg Code, which was to govern all human experimentation worldwide. The first line in that code says, the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The idea was revolutionary. The Hippocratic Oath, written in the 4th century BC, didn't require patient consent. And though the American Medical Association had issued rules protecting laboratory animals in 1910, no such rules existed for humans until Nuremberg. But the Nuremberg Code, like other codes that would come after it, wasn't law. It was essentially a list of recommendations. It wasn't routinely taught in medical schools, and many American researchers, including Southam, claimed not to know it existed. Those who did know about it often thought of it as the Nazi Code, something that applied to barbarians and dictators, not to American doctors. When Southam began injecting people with HeLa cells in 1954, there was no formal research oversight in the United States. Since the turn of the century, politicians had been introducing state and federal laws with hopes of regulating human experimentation. But physicians and researchers always protested. The bills were repeatedly voted down for fear of interfering with the progress of science, even though other countries, including, ironically, Prussia, had enacted regulations governing human research as early as 1891. In the United States, the only way to enforce research ethics was in the civil courts. There, lawyers could use the Nuremberg Code to establish whether a scientist was acting within the ethical boundaries of the profession. But taking a researcher to court required money, know-how, and the knowledge that you were being used for research in the first place. The term informed consent first appeared in court documents in 1957, in a civil court ruling on the case of a patient named Martin Salgo. He went under anesthesia for what he thought was a routine procedure and woke up permanently paralyzed from the waist down. The doctor hadn't told him the procedure carried any risks at all. The judge ruled against the doctor, saying, "A physician violates his duty to his patient and subjects himself to liability if he withholds any facts which are necessary to form the basis of an intelligent consent by the patient to the proposed treatment." He wrote that there needed to be full disclosure of facts necessary to an informed consent. Informed consent focused on what doctors were required to tell their patients. There was little mention of how it might apply to research like Southam's, in which subjects weren't the researcher's patients. And it would be decades before anyone thought to ask whether informed consent should apply in cases like Henrietta's, where scientists conduct research on tissues no longer attached to a person's body. But to the three doctors who refused to help with Southam's research, injecting cancer cells into a person without consent was a clear violation of basic human rights and the Nuremberg Code. Mandel didn't see it that way. He had a resident give the injections in their place. And on August 27, 1963, the three doctors wrote a resignation letter citing unethical research practices. They sent it to Mandel and at least one reporter. When Mandel got the letter, he called a meeting with one of the doctors and accused them of being overly sensitive because of their Jewish ancestry. One member of the hospital's board of directors, a lawyer named William Hyman, didn't think they were being overly sensitive. When he heard about the doctor's resignation, he asked to see the records of the patients in the study. But his request was denied. Meanwhile, just days after the doctors resigned, the New York Times ran a tiny news item deep in the paper under the headline, "Sweden Penalizes Cancer Specialist," about a cancer researcher named Bertil Björklund. He'd been giving himself and patients intravenous injections of vaccines made from HeLa cells, which he'd gotten from George Guy's lab in such enormous quantities, they joked that instead of injecting them, Björklund could just fill a pool with HeLa, or maybe even a lake, and swim around in it for immunity. Björklund's HeLa injections got him expelled from his laboratory, and Hyman hoped for similar results with Southam. So in December 1963, he sued the hospital for access to medical records related to the study. Hyman compared Southam's study to Nazi research and got affidavits from the three doctors who'd resigned. They described Southam's research using words like illegal, immoral, and deplorable. Hyman also got an affidavit from a fourth doctor explaining that the patients in the study wouldn't have been capable of giving informed consent even if Southam had asked. One had advanced Parkinson's disease and couldn't talk. Others spoke only Yiddish. One had multiple sclerosis and depressive psychosis. Regardless, Hyman wrote, "I was informed that consent was not necessary, that it was unlikely that Jewish patients would agree to live cancer cell injections." That caught the media's attention. The hospital called the suit misleading and fallacious. But newspapers and magazines ran headlines saying, "Patients injected with cells not told they were cancer. Scientific experts condemn ethics of cancer injection." They said the Nuremberg Code didn't seem to apply in the United States, and that there were no laws protecting research subjects. Science magazine called it the hottest public debate on medical ethics since the Nuremberg trials, and said, "The situation at present appears rather perilous for everyone." A reporter from Science asked Southam why, if the injections were as safe as he swore they were, he didn't inject himself. "Let's face it," Southam responded. "There are relatively few skilled cancer researchers, and it seems stupid to take even the little risk." Patients who'd unknowingly been injected with cancer cells by Southam read the articles and began contacting reporters. New York State Attorney General Louis Lefkowitz learned about Southam's research through the media as well, and immediately launched his own investigation. In a scathing 5-page document filled with exclamation points, he accused Southam and Mandel of fraud and unprofessional conduct, and demanded that the Board of Regents of the University of the State of New York revoke their medical licenses. Lefkowitz wrote, "Every human being has an inalienable right to determine what shall be done with his own body. These patients, then, had a right to know the contents of the syringe. And if this knowledge was to cause fear and anxiety or make them frightened, they had a right to be fearful and frightened and thus say no to the experiment." Many doctors testified before the Board of Regents and in the media on Southam's behalf, saying they'd been conducting similar research for decades. They argued that it was unnecessary to disclose all information to research subjects or get consent in all cases, and that Southam's behavior was considered ethical in the field. Southam's lawyers argued, "If the whole profession is doing it, how can you call it unprofessional conduct?" This rattled the Board of Regents. On June 10, 1965, its Medical Grievance Committee found Southam and Mandel guilty of fraud or deceit and unprofessional conduct in the practice of medicine, and recommended that their medical licenses be suspended for 1 year. The board wrote, "There is evidenced in the record in this proceeding an attitude on the part of some physicians that they can go ahead and do anything, and that the patient's consent is an empty formality. With this, we cannot agree." Their decision called for more specific guidelines in clinical research, saying, "We trust that this measure of discipline will serve as a stern warning that zeal for research must not be carried to the point where it violates the basic rights and immunities of a human person." The suspensions of Southam's and Mandel's licenses were stayed, leaving them both on 1 year probation instead, and the case seemed to have little impact on Southam's professional standing. Soon after the end of his probationary period, Southam was elected president of the American Association for Cancer Research. But his case brought about one of the largest research oversight changes in the history of experimentation on humans. Before the Board of Regents announced its decision, The negative press about Southam's work had gotten the attention of the NIH, which funded his research and required its investigators to get consent for all studies involving humans. In response to the Southam situation, the NIH investigated all their grantee institutions and found that only 9 out of 52 had any policy in place to protect the rights of research subjects. Only 16 used consent forms. The NIH concluded, in the setting in which the patient is involved in an experimental effort, the judgment of the investigator is not sufficient as a basis for reaching a conclusion concerning the ethical and moral set of questions in that relationship. As a result of its investigation, the NIH said that to qualify for funding, all proposals for research on human subjects had to be approved by review boards, independent bodies made up of professionals and laypeople of diverse races, classes, and backgrounds, to ensure that they met the NIH's ethics requirements, including detailed informed consent. Scientists said medical research was doomed. In a letter to the editor of Science, one of them warned, "When we are prevented from attempting seemingly innocuous studies of cancer behavior in humans, we may mark 1966 as the year in which all medical progress ceased." Later that year, a Harvard anesthesiologist named Henry Beecher published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that Southam's research was only one of hundreds of similarly unethical studies. Beecher published a detailed list of the 22 worst offenders, including researchers who'd injected children with hepatitis and others who'd poisoned patients under anesthesia using carbon dioxide. Southam's study was included as example number 17. Despite scientists' fears, the ethical crackdown didn't slow scientific progress. In fact, research flourished. And much of it involved Gila. Chapter 18. Strangest Hybrid, 1960 to 1966. By the 1960s, scientists joked that HeLa cells were so robust that they could probably survive in sink drains or on doorknobs. They were everywhere. The general public could grow HeLa at home using instructions from a Scientific American do-it-yourself article. And both Russian and American scientists had managed to grow HeLa in space. Henrietta's cells went up in the second satellite ever in orbit, which was launched by the Russian space program in 1960. And almost immediately afterward, NASA shot several vials of HeLa into space in the Discoverer 18 satellite. Researchers knew from simulated zero-gravity studies using animals that space travel could cause cardiovascular changes, degradation of bone and muscle, and a loss of red blood cells. They also knew radiation levels were higher beyond the ozone layer. But they didn't know what effects any of this would have on humans. Would it cause cellular changes, or even cell death? When the first humans went into orbit, Henrietta's cells went with them, so researchers could study the effects of space travel, as well as the nutritional needs of cells in space, and how cancerous and non-cancerous cells responded differently to zero gravity. What they found was disturbing. In mission after mission, non-cancerous cells grew normally in orbit, but HeLa became more powerful, dividing faster with each trip. And HeLa cells weren't the only ones behaving strangely. Since the start of the decade, researchers had been noticing two new things about all cultured cells. First, it seemed that all normal cells growing in culture eventually died or underwent spontaneous transformation and became cancerous. This phenomenon was exciting for researchers trying to understand the mechanisms of cancer, because it suggested that they might be able to study the moment a normal cell becomes malignant. But it was disturbing for those trying to use cell culture to develop medical therapies. George Hyatt, a Navy doctor working with the National Cancer Institute, had experienced this phenomenon firsthand. He'd cultured human skin cells for treating badly burned soldiers, then created a wound on a young volunteer officer's arm and smeared the cells across it, hoping they'd grow to form a new layer of skin. If it worked, it might mean doctors could use skin cell transplants to treat wounds in the field. The cells did grow, but when Hyatt biopsied them a few weeks later, they were all cancerous. He panicked, removed the cells, and hadn't tried transplanting skin cells since. The other unusual thing scientists had noticed about cells growing in culture was that once they transformed and became cancerous, they all behaved alike, dividing identically and producing exactly the same proteins and enzymes, even though they'd all produced different ones before becoming malignant. Louis Coryell, a renowned cell culturist, thought he might have an explanation. He published a paper suggesting that perhaps transformed cells behaved the same not because they'd become cancerous, but because they'd been contaminated by something, most likely a virus or bacterium, that made them behave similarly. Almost as an aside, he pointed out one possibility that other researchers hadn't considered. All transformed cells seem to behave identically to HeLa, he wrote, which could mean that HeLa was the contaminant. Soon after his paper was published, Coryell and a few other top tissue culturists called an urgent meeting to talk about the state of their field, which they worried was becoming a disaster. They'd mastered the techniques of cell culture and simplified them to such a degree that, as one researcher put it, they'd made it possible for even the rank amateur to grow a few cultures. In recent years, using tissue samples from themselves, their families, and their patients, scientists had grown cells of all kinds, prostate cancer, appendix, foreskin, even bits of human cornea, often with surprising ease. Researchers were using that growing library of cells to make historic discoveries that cigarettes caused lung cancer, how X-rays and certain chemicals transformed normal cells into malignant ones, why normal cells stopped growing and cancer cells didn't. And the National Cancer Institute was using various cells, including HeLa, to screen more than 30,000 chemicals and plant extracts, which would yield several of today's most widely used and effective chemotherapy drugs, including vincristine and Taxol. Despite the importance of this research, many scientists seemed cavalier about their cultures. Few kept clear records of which cells grew from which donors, and many mislabeled their cultures, if they labeled them at all. For scientists doing research that wasn't cell-specific, like investigating the effects of radiation on DNA, not knowing what kind of cell they were working on might not affect the outcome of their research. But if cells were contaminated or mislabeled in research that was cell-specific, as much research was, the results would be worthless. Regardless, the culturists who called the meeting said precision was essential in science, and researchers should know what cells they were using and whether they were contaminated. According to Robert Stevenson, one of the scientists involved in the meeting, their goal was to keep the field from degenerating into complete chaos. The group encouraged researchers to use protective measures, like working under hoods with suction that pulled air and potential contaminants into a filtration system. And they recommended that the NIH establish a reference collection of cells, a central bank where all cultures would be tested, cataloged, and stored under maximum security using state-of-the-art sterile techniques. The NIH agreed and formed a cell culture collection committee made up of tissue culturalists including William Scherer, Lou Coryell, and Robert Stevenson. Their mission was to establish a nonprofit federal cell bank at the American Type Culture Collection, ATCC, which had been distributing and monitoring the purity of bacteria, fungi, yeast, and viruses since 1925, but never cultured cells. The scientists on the collection committee set out to create the Fort Knox of pure, uncontaminated cell culture. They transported cultures in locked suitcases and developed a list of criteria all cells had to meet before being banked. Each had to be tested for any possible contamination, and they all had to come directly from the original source. Cell number one in the ATCC's collection was the L cell, the original immortal mouse cell line grown by Wilton Earle. For cell number two, the committee contacted Guy, asking for a sample from the original HeLa culture. But in his initial excitement, Guy had given all the original HeLa cells to other researchers and kept none for himself. He eventually tracked some down in the lab of William Shearer, who'd used some of the original HeLa sample in their polio research. Initially, the committee could only test samples for viral and bacterial contamination. But soon a few of its members developed a test for cross-species contamination, so they could determine whether cultures labeled as being from one animal type were actually from another. They quickly found that of 10 cell lines thought to be from 9 different species, including dog, pig, and duck, all but one were actually from primates. They promptly relabeled those cultures, and it seemed they'd gotten the situation under control without attracting any bad publicity. The media, it turned out, was far more interested in a bit of HeLa-related news that was almost as sensational as Alexis Carrel's immortal chicken heart. And it all started with cell sex. In 1960, French researchers had discovered that when cells were infected with certain viruses in culture, they clumped together and sometimes fused. When they fused, the genetic material from the two cells combined, as with sperm meeting egg. The technical name for this was somatic cell fusion, but some researchers called it cell sex. It was different from sperm and egg sex in several important ways. Somatic cells were cells of the body, like skin cells, and their union produced offspring every few hours. Perhaps most important, cell sex was entirely controlled by researchers. Genetically speaking, humans are terrible research subjects. We're genetically promiscuous. We mate with anyone we choose, and we don't take kindly to scientists telling us who to reproduce with. Plus, unlike plants and mice, it takes us decades to produce enough offspring to give scientists much meaningful data. Since the mid-1800s, scientists had studied genes by breeding plants and animals in specific ways, a smooth pea with a wrinkled one, a brown mouse with a white one, then breeding their offspring to see how genetic traits passed from one generation to the next. But they couldn't study human genetics the same way. Cell sex solved that problem, because it meant researchers could combine cells with any traits they wanted and study how those traits were passed along. In 1965, two British scientists, Henry Harris and John Watkins, took cell sex an important step further. They fused HeLa cells with mouse cells and created the first human-animal hybrids, cells that contained equal amounts of DNA from Henrietta and a mouse. By doing this, they helped make it possible to study what genes do and how they work. In addition to the HeLa mouse hybrid, Harris fused HeLa with chicken cells that had lost their ability to reproduce. His hunch was that when those deactivated chicken cells fused with HeLa, something inside HeLa would essentially turn the chicken cell back on. He was right. He didn't know how it worked yet, but his discovery showed that something in cells regulated genes, and if scientists could figure out how to turn disease genes off, they might be able to create a form of gene therapy. Soon after Harris's HeLa chicken study, a pair of researchers at New York University discovered that human-mouse hybrids lost their human chromosomes over time, leaving only the mouse chromosomes. This allowed scientists to begin mapping human genes to specific chromosomes by tracking the order in which genetic traits vanished. If a chromosome disappeared and production of a certain enzyme stopped, researchers knew the gene for that enzyme must be on the most recently vanished chromosome. Scientists in laboratories throughout North America and Europe began fusing cells and using them to map genetic traits to specific chromosomes, creating a precursor to the human genome map we have today. They used hybrids to create the first monoclonal antibodies, special proteins later used to create cancer therapies like Herceptin, and to identify the blood groups that increased the safety of transfusions. They also used them to study the role of immunity in organ transplantation. Hybrids proved it was possible for DNA from two unrelated individuals, even of different species, to survive together inside cells without one rejecting the other, which meant the mechanism for rejecting transplanted organs had to be outside cells. Scientists were ecstatic about hybrids. But throughout the United States and Britain, the public panicked as the media published one sensational headline after the next. Man-animal cells are bred in lab. The next step could be tree men. Scientists create monsters. The Times of London called the Gila mouse cells the strangest hybrid form of life ever seen in the lab or out of it. A Washington Post editorial said, "We cannot afford any artificially induced mouse men." It called the research horrendous and said the researchers should leave humans alone and go back to their yeasts and fungi. One article ran with an image of a half-human, half-mouse creature with a long, scaly tail. Another ran with a cartoon of a hippopotamus woman reading the newspaper at a bus stop. The British press called the Gila hybrids an assault on life, and portrayed Harris as a mad scientist. And Harris didn't help the situation. He caused near pandemonium when he appeared in a BBC documentary saying that the eggs of man and ape could now be joined to create a mape. Harris and Watkins wrote letters to editors complaining that they'd been quoted out of context, their story sensationalized to distort, misrepresent, and terrify. They assured the public that they were just creating cells, not trying to produce centaurs. But it didn't help. A public survey about their research was overwhelmingly negative, calling it pointless and dangerous, an example of men trying to be gods. And the PR problem for cell culture was only going to get worse from there. Chapter 19. The most critical time on this earth is now. 1966 to 1973. When Deborah was a junior in high school, at the age of 16, she got pregnant with her first child. Babette cried when she found out. Deborah stopped going to school, and Babette said, "Don't get too comfortable, 'cause you're going to graduate." Deborah yelled right back, saying she couldn't go to school all big and pregnant. "That don't matter," Babette said. "You're going to that special girls' school where all the pregnant girls have big bellies just like you." Deborah refused. But Babette filled out the application for her and dragged her there for her first day of class. On November 10th, 1966, Deborah gave birth to Alfred Jr., who she named after his father, Alfred Cheetah Carter, the boy Galen had once been jealous of. Each morning, Babette made Deborah's lunch, got her to school, then took care of Alfred all day and most of the night so Deborah could go to class and study. When Deborah graduated, Babette made her get her first job. Whether Deborah liked it or not, Babette was going to help her and that baby. Deborah's older brothers were doing fine on their own. Lawrence went into business for himself, opening a convenience store in the basement of an old townhouse. Sunny had graduated from high school, joined the Air Force, and grown into a handsome ladies' man. He did some running around, but pretty much stayed out of trouble. Their younger brother, Joe, was another story. Authority didn't agree with Joe. He argued with teachers and brawled with other students. He dropped out of school in the 7th grade and ended up in court for assault by striking right after his 17th birthday. He joined the military at 18, but his anger and attitude got him in even more trouble there. He fought his superiors and other soldiers. Sometimes he ended up in the hospital, but more often than not, his fighting landed him in solitary confinement, a dark hole with dirt walls ominously similar to the basement where Ethel once locked him as a child. He preferred being in the hole because it meant no one would bother him. As soon as they let him out, he'd fight another soldier or get belligerent with an officer, and they'd throw him back in. He spent 9 months in the service, most of it sitting in the hole, growing angrier and angrier. After multiple psychiatric evaluations and treatments, Joe was discharged for an inability to adjust emotionally to military life. His family had hoped the military would help control his rage and teach him some discipline and respect for authority. Instead, he came out of the military angrier than ever. A week or so after Joe got home from the military, a tall, skinny neighborhood kid named Ivy walked up to him with a knife and asked him if he wanted to start something. Most people wouldn't have done that. At 19, Joe was at least 4 inches shorter than Ivy and only 155 pounds, but people in the neighborhood called him Crazy Joe because he seemed to enjoy violence. Ivy didn't care. He'd been drinking heavily and shooting heroin for years, and he was covered in scars from fighting. He told Joe he was going to kill him. Joe ignored Ivy the first time. Then, about 3 months later, on September 12, 1970, Joe was walking down an East Baltimore street with his friend June. It was Saturday night. They'd been drinking, and they'd just started talking up a group of young girls when three other men walked up the street toward them. One of those men was Eldridge Lee Ivy. When Ivy saw Joe and June talking to the girls, he yelled, saying one of them was his cousin and they'd better stop messing with her. "I'm tired of your junk," June yelled back. The two started arguing, and when Ivy threatened to punch June in the face, Joe jumped between them, calmly telling Ivy he would do no such thing. Ivy grabbed Joe by the neck, choking him while his two friends tried to pull him off. Joe kicked and yelled, "I'm gonna kill your motherfucking ass!" But Ivy beat him bloody, while June watched, terrified. That night, Joe knocked on Deborah's door. He stared ahead, covered in blood, eyes burning with hate as she cleaned his face and put him on her couch to sober up with some ice packs. He glared at the wall all night, looking scarier and angrier than Deborah had ever seen a person look. The next morning, Joe went into Deborah's kitchen and took her good carving knife with the black wood handle. 2 days later, on September 15, 1970, Joe went to work at his job driving for a local trucking company. By 5 o'clock, he and a co-worker had shared a fifth of old granddad whiskey, then another pint. It was still daylight out when Joe got off work and walked to the corner of Landvale and Montford Avenues in East Baltimore, where Ivy stood on the front stoop of his house, talking to some friends. Joe crossed the street and said, "Hi, Ivy," then stabbed him in the chest with Deborah's knife. The blade went straight through Ivy's heart. He staggered down the street and into a neighbor's house with Joe close behind, then collapsed face down into a pool of his own blood, yelling, "Oh, I'm dying. Call an ambulance." But it was too late. When a fireman arrived a few minutes later, Ivy was dead. Joe walked away from the murder scene, dropped the knife in a nearby alley, and headed to a payphone to call his father. But the police had beaten him to it. They'd told Day his son had killed a boy. Sonny and Lawrence told their father to get Joe to Clover, back to the tobacco farms, where he could hide from the law and be safe. Deborah said they were crazy. He got to turn himself in, she told them. The police got a warrant out saying he wanted dead or alive. But the men didn't listen. Day gave Joe $20 and put him on a Trailways bus to Clover. In Laxtown, Joe drank all day, picked fights with his cousins, and threatened to kill several of them, including Cootie. By the end of Joe's first week, Cootie called Day saying somebody had better come get Joe before he killed someone else or got himself shot. Sonny borrowed Day's car, picked Joe up in Clover, and took him to D.C. to stay with a friend. But Joe couldn't get along there either. The next morning, he called Sonny and said, "Come pick me up. I want to turn myself in." On the morning of September 29, 1970, Joe walked into the Baltimore police headquarters and calmly said, "I'm Joe Lax. I'm wanted 'cause I killed Ivy." Then he filled out this form. "Is the defendant employed? No. Cash on hand or in banks? Zero. Name of parents? David Lax. Have they been to see you? No. Do you have any friends or members of your family that can get you an attorney? No. Can't afford one." After that, Joe waited. He knew he was going to plead guilty. He just wanted to get on with it. After 5 months awaiting trial in a cell, Joe wrote this letter to the criminal court judge.
"Dear Sir or Your Honor, in the most critical time on this earth is now, on this atmosphere today, of my mistake, no, I'll say wrong comprehension of corruption that I've placed on myself. A very mislead problem that was not meant to be. Feel so frustration in making me obnoxious within me, asking for a speedily trial to let me know what lays ahead in the future. I feel as though I'd sure be castigated or chastised for the wrong I've did, so I'm ready to get it over now with it. Joe Lax. Speedily trial. Thank you, Your Honor."
Finally, on April 6, 1971, 7 months after Ivy's death, Joe stood in a courtroom and pleaded guilty to murder in the second degree, with Sonny watching nearby. The judge warned Joe repeatedly that a guilty plea meant waiving his right to a trial, his right to testify, and his right to appeal her ruling. As the judge spoke, he said,
"Yes, ma'am,"
and
"No, ma'am."
He told her the alcohol had made him do it, and that he hadn't meant to kill Ivy.
"I tried to hit on the top of his shoulder, and he panicked and turned and caught it in the chest," Joe said. "I was trying to wound him so I wouldn't let him hurt me. He told me he was going to kill me that Saturday night me and him got into the argument. I just hope you see I was trying to protect my life. I was not really wanting any trouble out of no one at all."
But Ivy's 14-year-old neighbor, who'd seen the whole thing, said Joe had walked right up and stabbed Ivy in the chest, then tried to stab him again in the back as he staggered away. When Joe stepped from the stand, his court-appointed lawyer approached the judge to make this final point.
"The only thing I would add, Your Honor, is that I talked to his brother about the young man, and the problem that he also had in the army is a problem that possibly got him into the situation he is in court for today. For some reason, somewhere in his life, he has gotten an inferiority complex, and it seems to be a sizable one. It seems that whenever he is confronted by any individual, he sort of takes it rather aggressively, more so than the average individual. For the record, he had some psychiatric help in the service, but he has never been in any hospital."
Without knowing anything about Joe's life or the abuse he experienced as a child, his lawyer said, "He feels it more necessary to protect himself than the average individual, and possibly this sets him off, where it would not set off the average person."
"Do people call you Crazy Joe?" the judge asked. There was a few friends that called me that,
Joe said. Do you know why they call you that?
No, ma'am,
he said. The judge accepted Joe's guilty plea, but asked to see medical and psychiatric reports before deciding his sentence. Those records are sealed, but whatever they contained led her to give him a sentence of only 15 years out of a possible 30. The state sent Joe to the Maryland Correctional Institution in Hagerstown, a medium-security prison about 75 miles west of Baltimore. In the beginning, Joe spent his time in prison much as he'd spent it in the military, in the hole for insubordination and fighting. But eventually, he stopped fighting and focused his energy inward. Joe found Islam and began spending all his time studying the Quran in his cell. Soon, he changed his name to Zakaria Bari Abdul Rahman. Meanwhile, on the outside, things were looking pretty good for the other Lax brothers. Sonny had just been honorably discharged from the Air Force, and Lawrence had a good job working for the railroad. But things weren't so good for Deborah. By the time Zakaria ended up in prison, Deborah had married Cheetah in a blue chiffon dress in Bobette and Lawrence's living room. She was 18. When Deborah and Cheetah first met, he threw a bowling ball at her on the sidewalk in front of her house. She thought he was playing, but things only got worse after they married. Soon after their second child, Latonya, was born, Cheetah fell into drugs and started beating Deborah when he was high. Then he started running the streets, disappearing with other women for nights on end, and coming back only to sell drugs out of the house while Deborah's children sat and watched. One day, as Deborah stood at the sink doing dishes, her hands covered in soap bubbles, Cheetah ran into the kitchen yelling something about her sleeping around on him. Then he smacked her.
Don't do that again, Deborah said, standing stone still, her hands in the dishwater.
Cheetah grabbed a plate from the drying rack and broke it across the side of her face.
Don't you put your hands back on me no more,
Deborah screamed, her hand shooting out of the dishwater, gripping a serrated steak knife. Cheetah raised his arm to hit her again, but he was clumsy from the drugs and booze. Deborah blocked him with her empty hand and pinned him against the wall. She stuck the tip of the knife into his chest just deep enough to break the skin, then dragged it down past his navel as Cheetah screamed, calling her crazy. He left her alone for a few days after that, but eventually came home drunk and high and started beating her again. As Cheetah kicked her one night in the living room, Deborah yelled,
"Why do you always have to be arguing and fussing with me?"
When he didn't answer, Deborah decided right then she wanted him dead. He turned and staggered toward the stairs of their apartment, still yelling, and Deborah pushed him hard as she could. He tumbled to the bottom where he lay bleeding. Deborah stared at him from the top of the stairs, feeling nothing, no fear, no emotion. When he moved, she walked down the steps and dragged him through their basement onto the sidewalk outside. It was the middle of winter and snowing. Deborah dropped him on the ground in front of the house without a coat, slammed the door, and went upstairs to sleep. The next morning, she woke up hoping he'd frozen to death. But instead, he was sitting on their front stoop, bruised and cold.
"I feel like some guys jumped me and beat me up," he told her.
She let him in the house and got him washed and fed, all the while thinking what a damn fool he was. While Cheetah slept it off, Deborah called Bobette saying,
"This is it. He gonna die tonight."
"What are you talking about?"
Bobette asked.
"I got the monkey wrench," Deborah said. "I'm gonna splatter his brains all over the wall. I'm sick of it."
"Don't do it, Dale," Bobette said. "Look where it got Zakaria. He's in jail. You killed that man, then what about your children? Now get that monkey wrench out of there."
The next day, after Cheetah left for work, A moving van pulled up to the house. Deborah took the children and everything they owned, then hid at her father's house until she could find her own apartment. As Deborah worked two jobs and struggled to settle into her new life as a single mother, she had no idea she was about to get news that would be harder to handle than anything Cheetah had done. Chapter 20. The Gila Bomb, 1966. In September 1966, a geneticist named Stanley Gartler walked up to the podium at a hotel in Bedford, Pennsylvania. There, in front of George Guy and the other giants of cell culture, Gartler announced that he'd found a technical problem in their field. He was at the second decennial review conference on cell tissue and organ culture, with more than 700 other scientists. They'd come from biotech companies and academia. They'd traveled from New York, England, the Netherlands, Alaska, Japan, and everywhere between to discuss the future of cell culture. The room buzzed with excitement as everyone talked about cell cloning and hybrids, mapping human genes, and using cultures to cure cancer. Few there had heard of Stanley Gartler, but that was about to change. Gartler leaned into the microphone and told the audience that in the process of looking for new genetic markers for his research, he'd found that 18 of the most commonly used cell cultures had one thing in common. They all contained a rare genetic marker called glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase A, G6-PDA, which was present almost exclusively in Black Americans, and even among them it was fairly rare. "I have not been able to ascertain the supposed racial origin of all 18 lines," Gartler told the audience. "It is known, however, that at least some of these are from Caucasians, and that at least one, Gila, is from a Negro." He knew this, because a few months earlier he'd written George Guy, "I am interested in the racial origin of the person from whom your Gila cell line was initiated. I have checked a number of the early papers describing the development of the Gila cell line, but have not been able to find any information pertaining to the race of the donor." When Guy responded that Gila cells had come from a colored woman, Gartler knew he'd found the source of the problem. "It seems to me the simplest explanation," he told the audience, "is that they are all Gila cell contaminants." Scientists knew they had to keep their cultures free from bacterial and viral contamination, and they knew it was possible for cells to contaminate one another if they got mixed up in culture. But when it came to Gila, they had no idea what they were up against. It turned out Henrietta's cells could float through the air on dust particles. They could travel from one culture to the next on unwashed hands or used pipettes. They could ride from lab to lab on researchers' coats and shoes or through ventilation systems. And they were strong. If just one Gila cell landed in a culture dish, it took over, consuming all the media and filling all the space. Gartler's findings did not go over well. In the 15 years since Guy had first grown Gila, the number of published articles involving cell culture had more than tripled each year. Scientists had spent millions conducting research on those cells to study the behavior of each tissue type, comparing one to another, testing the unique responses of different cell types to specific drugs, chemicals, or environments. If all those cells were in fact Gila, it would mean that millions of dollars had been wasted, and researchers who'd found that various cells behave differently in culture could have some explaining to do. Years later, Robert Stevenson, who became president of the American Type Culture Collection, described Gartler's talk to me this way. "He showed up at that meeting with no background or anything else in cell culture and proceeded to drop a turd in the punch bowl." Stevenson and other members of the Cell Culture Collection Committee sat stunned in the audience as Gartler pointed to a chart on the wall listing the 18 cell lines that had been contaminated by Gila, along with the names of the people or places he'd gotten them from. At least 6 of the contaminated lines came from the ATCC. Gila had penetrated Fort Knox. At that point, the ATCC's collection had grown to dozens of different types of cells, all guaranteed to be free from viral and bacterial contamination and tested to ensure that they hadn't been contaminated with cells from another species. But there was no test to see if one human cell had contaminated another. And to the naked eye, most cells growing in culture looked the same. Now, Gartler was essentially telling the audience that all those years researchers thought they were creating a library of human tissues, they'd probably just been growing and regrowing Gila. He pointed out that a few years earlier, when scientists started taking protective measures against cross-species contamination, such as working under sterile hoods, it had suddenly become harder to grow new cell lines. And in fact, very few new human cell lines have been reported since. Not only that, he said, but there had been no new examples of so-called spontaneous transformed human cell cultures since. Everyone in the audience knew what that meant. On top of saying they'd possibly wasted more than a decade and millions of research dollars, Gartler was also suggesting that spontaneous transformation, one of the most celebrated prospects for finding a cure for cancer, might not exist. Normal cells didn't spontaneously become cancerous, he said. They were simply taken over by Gila. Gartler concluded his talk by saying, "Where the investigator has assumed a specific tissue of origin of the cell line, in other words, liver or bone marrow, the work is open to serious question, and in my opinion, would best be discarded." The room sat silent, dumbfounded, until T.C. Hsu, the chair of Gartler's conference session, spoke. Hsu was the University of Texas geneticist whose earlier work with Gila and other cells had made it possible to discover the correct number of human chromosomes. "A few years ago, I voiced some suspicion about cell line contamination," Hsu said. "So I am happy about the paper by Dr. Gartler, and am also sure he has made many people unhappy." He was right, and those people quickly began asking questions. "How long did you keep them in your laboratory?" one scientist asked, suggesting that Gartler had contaminated the cells himself after they arrived in his lab. "They were analyzed before being grown in my laboratory," Gartler responded. "They didn't send them to you frozen?" the scientist asked, knowing that contamination could have occurred while they thawed. Gartler said that didn't matter. The cells didn't have to be thawed to be tested. Another scientist wanted to know if the similarity